Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support. Welcome, everyone, to another very special episode of Brainstorm Brewery. We keep coming with those hits. We just got off of the Ray Future Pro, and now we bring you a PTQ winner. He's a fan of the podcast, actually, and he writes for the website, brainstormbrewery.com. You might know him as, he's actually could probably considered the super fan of the podcast. This is Sander Vanderzee.
Hello, thanks for having me, and you can definitely call me the super fan according to Jason.
Number one super fan, I think I said.
Numero uno.
Yeah, see, we're not like heavy metal where their super fans, you know, tattoo their logo on their chest, but you know, hey.
Yeah, Sander, put your money where your mouth is and get a Brainstorm Brewery tattoo.
I just want a PTQ so I can wear your shirt to the Pro Tool.
Hey.
Yeah. We'll accept that.
Shirts can be taken off. That is mere lip service.
So, it was suggested to me that I should wear my deck list on the front of my shirt and my cyber pen on the back of my shirt. And that's also something I wanted to do, really.
That would be hilarious, actually. Huh. Who gave you that idea?
Just some random opponents.
I think maybe their advice is not the best to take at the Pro Tour. Hmm. But congratulations on I'm winning the PTQ. Why don't you tell everybody, you know, where you're from and how long you've been playing Magic and all that?
So I'm Sander. I'm just from the Netherlands, the northern part. I've been playing Magic for about 5 years right now. Zendikar, really. Did play a little bit beforehand in high school, but that wasn't much during the Ravnica times. I began playing PTQs about a year ago. PTQ Delft was my first top 8 last year, Modern as well. Playing the same deck, surprise, surprise. And took a little break 2 months right before this, and I was convinced to play another PTQ, and just things happened on their own.
Awesome. I was glad to hear that you won that. So what were you playing? What was the deck? And was there any, like, tense moments or anything that you – any highlights you want to let people know about?
Many sweat-breaking moments. I can sum the deck up with a couple of words. Mountain, Lava Spike, go.
Oh, so you're playing Birthing Pod.
Burning Pod, yes, definitely, with the R instead of the T. Basically, I played Boros Burn with a sideboard Destructive Revelry. I call it the Burning Bridges myself because the sideboard also featured Ensnaring Bridge, although it didn't do much in this Magic game.
Well, that's awesome. So you are going to – is this the Pro Tour after Honolulu, or was this for
this
Honolulu?
This is Pro Tour Honolulu. I'm going to Hawaii.
Oh, lucky
which
you.
Which is insane. Yeah, absolutely. I was like – where is this Pro Tour? Yeah, it's in Honolulu. I was like, what? Honolulu? Okay, yeah, I'm in.
That is not a bad place to start your career on the Pro Tour.
Yeah, I went there a couple years ago. I live on the West Coast, so it's actually pretty cheap for me to fly to Hawaii. And, like, it's literally a paradise. Like, I was on a beach. You know, you get a car, drive away from the Waikiki. It's just horrid over there. It's like a tourist trap. And get out to see the island is just beautiful. It's literally a paradise, so... Lucky you. I'm glad to hear that, you know, crushed it in Hawaii.
It being in Honolulu actually made people that weren't playing Magic interested in my win. And a lot of people actually want to go with me, but they don't realize that it's quite expensive to fly. So,
hey, well, that's awesome to hear. And, you know, this is so you're international. You're making it happen. You're getting the good flight. This is why. So we're having a PTQ change now, though.
I had a relatively easy way to get onto the Pro Tour, and that would no longer be the case because the PTQ season or the PTQ changes are coming. Don't use this as a segue.
We'll use that as a segue. It's already in. Yeah, there's some changes. We're going to talk about it later. No. There's the PTQ changes, but right now we're going to talk to Jason about Boston because he was out there in Boston doing it big. Slick Jagger, it was his birthday. Shout out to him and a lot of other awesome people was there. Friends of the cast, Scotty Mack and Jason Real Evil Genius. They joined forces with Larry Swayze to form Team Geist, and they all day-tuned. I believe Scotty made the money. So congratulations to them. So, you know, it was an insane event. But Jason, you were on the floor. You wanna let us know what was going on?
Was I on the floor? Was I really? So Slick Jagger and I were celebrating his birthday with a nice expensive charcuterie plate and some very, very nice rare beer at a bar called the Armsby Abbey in Worcester, Mass. And he looked at me and he says, you know, nobody does GPs the way we do. I did not spend a ton of time on the floor. I did go to the convention center every day, did some trading, played some EDH, but I was definitely not pulling the 10, 12-hour days like I used to. But you can't ignore that completely. If you're going to drive all the way there, you really got to pay attention to what's going on the floor. The big tech that I noticed out of Boston was people starting to include Insol Artifact in Affinity. And everybody was asking, well, what do you take out? I was actually, I run Affinity in Modern, and I'm playing Galvanic Blast, and I think Insol Artifact is going to do a lot more work than Galv Blast. As good as that is against, you know, all the mana dorks and stuff out of Pod. Pod's not actually a terrible matchup to begin with, so you don't really need to improve one of your better matchups. So I think that's a good change to be making. That's something you want to pay attention to, what's going on the floor. There was the charity auction for Mariah, the Team Panda charity auction going on. Scott Fisher, the artist, made his first GP appearance in something like 10 years. So the other artists were Christopher Rush and RK Post, who do a lot of these things. So Fisher had, you know, a huge line. It was a great opportunity to get stuff by him signed if you've never seen him at a GP before because you were there and he wasn't. Yeah, Boston was I keep calling it Boston. It was like an hour from Boston. They shouldn't even be able to call it Boston. GP Worcester was a great time. There were so many people in attendance, they actually had to split the Grand Prix into two pods of roughly like 1350. And play those separately and then have everybody come together for day two. That's how many people there were. So, you know, this is probably the new normal for Grand Prix, you know, having to be split up into pods because, you know, a 3,000 person event would be a little bit unwieldy. So that creates its own challenges. We're not really going to get into that too much here today, but, that's definitely something that happened. I think this is the last modern, Grand Prix for a while. So it definitely went out with a bang.
Great. Well, yeah, I mean, I think the Insol Artifact is a big thing to come out of it. I mean, cause obviously I've seen other people talk about cutting Seal Overseer for it. But obviously having a 5/5 indestructible Dark Seal Citadel is pretty good. You know, so the other thing that happened as a result of this event, there were also some interesting poison decks in top eight, but it was Affinity that kind of drew the most hype with the Insol Artifact tech. And it actually caused the foil of the card to go up to $20 this past weekend from, you know, I assume a couple bucks. So, Jason, why don't you talk about just, you know, your perceptions having been there on that card and having played Affinity and the price of it and, you know, what that means to us in a Finance 101 sort of sense.
Well, I think this is sort of a unique case because I think it's created a bit of a perfect storm. We have three things going on. We have relative scarcity because M15 just came out. There weren't a whole lot of people selling on TCG Player. You know, there weren't a whole lot of dealers going through and making sure the first thing they do is pull out the foil and soul artifacts and get those posted up on TCG Player and eBay. There's real scarcity going on, because it was underlooked. It was overlooked and underrated at first. And the set's new. So nobody was saying, boy, I hope I bust a foil and soul artifact in my box. You know, nobody was really trading for them and making sure they had those accessible. People are going to be finding these. The price is going to go down a little bit. The other thing was the tech was relatively surprising, you know, so that it had that going for it. The fact that it's an uncommon means only the foils are relevant. Like, you know, Insol Artifact's not going to be a $5 card based on, you know, modern play. But since modern is a pseudo-eternal format, it's an older format. So the foils are relevant. People will tend to foil out non-rotating decks more than they would, you know, a rotating deck like their standard deck. So this, you know, it's got a lot of things going for it. And, the fact that it busted out relatively close to the release of the set means foil is going to be real scarce and they're going to be real expensive.
So one thing that's going on right now is we're going to move into our 101. What's going on is you're getting, following event coverage. You know, this is a major part of finance, and a lot of people that are new, they don't realize how important the shifting of prices are and how it's tied over to the events. If you follow the events and you pay attention to what cards are being played, this is a major way that you find your advantage in Magic Finance. So this is a major thing. This is a way to step your game up. This could almost be saying, you know, Finance 102. You know, you got to get your bases down, and then this is definitely how you get into the next level. But let's jump into this. You guys want to tell some people about what to do when you're following event coverage and
anything else? Yeah, I mean, now, you know, the whole following event coverage thing has obviously come a long way, even in the last couple of years. If you remember back to Pro's Tour Avsin Restored, I was kind of the one who broke the news after following someone on Twitter that, hey, Wolfer Silverheart is all over the place. Obviously, they ended up doing very well in that event and shooting up in price. But if you're following the event closely, and that doesn't always just mean the video coverage, it can mean the text coverage, or a lot of the times following people on Twitter, talking about, you know, what's sold out or the people who want to give insight into what they're playing or more often what they see other people playing, you can kind of get ahead on stuff like that. You know, it's certainly dangerous because, like, for every Wolf or Silverheart that, you know, quadruples or whatever in price and you make a lot of money, there's the Niv-Magus Elemental deck that gets hyped by the video team at the start of the event, and everyone goes all in on it, and then it's crashed by the end of the day because it turns out the deck's not that good. So there's definitely a, you know, an upside and a downside to it. So you have to be able to very quickly, because the things happen very fast, you have to watch and be able to very quickly make up your mind for stuff. You know, and in my opinion, whatever deck that you turn on the stream in the first round and they say, oh, such and such person has this really innovative deck that uses this card, blah, blah, blah. Well, a lot of the times they're talking about the deck because it's interesting, not necessarily because it's good, because at the very least it's unproven. So it's really important, even if it means getting in a little later, I think, to watch out for the hype of those, you know, you don't want that Niv-Mage Elemental that's hyped because it's new. You want the Wolf or Silverheart that puts a bunch of copies into day two. That's what you want to watch for, is for those actual results.
And people are still waiting. If you'll notice, the foil and soul artifacts didn't really sell out until Monday of this week. You know, like, people still waited for that top eight to get posted, and, you know, for the results to get posted. So I think if a deck's making day two, that's probably a pretty good indication. So the sooner you get in, the more you're risking, but the higher your potential reward is, because you have nobody fighting you for those copies. I heard people say there was stuff disappearing out of their shopping cart because there was a crush of people on Monday trying to get those copies up. So you can definitely wait for results and risk less, or you can try to be the first one buying in, like, you know, Friday afternoon when you first see the tech, and, you know, risk a lot. So you just got to figure out where your point is, you know, how much risk you want to manage, and that the rewards are potentially higher the earlier you buy in.
Another thing to watch for is definitely Magic Online, like with Theros. When Theros was just released, that you started to see movement on Master of Waves and some on the Devotion creatures. And this was an indicator to something to come. People couldn't understand why Master of Waves was considered a crappy card during spoiler season, but the pros are buying into it. There's a limited supply. So if you start seeing movement on Magic Online, that might give you some indicators that you might have a safe card to buy into, and you got to watch out for that. But also, because things move fast, there's a lot of people out there that are trying to do the same thing you're doing, and some people will buy into the hype and then just push a card that beyond where it is. If you buy into the hype, you may feel bad when it starts to crash and you weren't able to get out, you know, before it went back to its normal price.
So, Sander, why don't you jump in? Because I know you wanted to talk a little bit about how to balance the hype of a card, you know, versus the consistency it has in a format.
Yeah, because one of the things you have to watch for, seriously, is that once you acquire copies, it's not that easy to get rid of. So if anything goes wrong, you're stuck with the copies, simply to put that. So one of the things to watch for is the consistency that the card puts up. Because if a card can perform consistently over several tournaments, say, for example, Ansel Artifact made its appearance not only on GP Boston, but as well at some of the PTQs, this might indicate that the card itself, despite being in the common, have a real place in the format, thus have a longer-term relevant financial impact. Whereas if you see the Niv-Magus Elemental from like 1 or 2 years ago, it really didn't do anything because there were no results, there were no large quantity or number of decks. For example, only a small number of people, I believe, played the deck number three or four at best that ran it, whereas the Ensoul Artifact has a significant more significantly larger backing than a card such as Niv-Magus Elemental, and it will impact the current price and the future price.
Right, yeah, and I think that speaks to whether or not a card is something you want to, even if you can make money on it, whether you want to pick it up and get rid of it right away. You know, like Niv-Magus Elemental is the example we're using. I don't even know if there was a window to make money on that one. It went so fast. But there have been some other cards that kind of break out for one event and then fall back under the radar. So yeah, that consistency really determines how fast you need to get rid of something, how stable it is to sit on. And you know, that can kind of inform the price you're looking to sell at.
And don't buy into the hype, guys. Know when you missed the window. I think it's pretty obvious we've all missed the window on Ensoul Artifact, the foils. So don't be the person that buys into the hype. Because if the card hits quote-unquote 20, the people that bought in at $2 are looking to sell for 10. Don't be the guy that buys at 10 thinking you're going to get out for 20. Because as the people rummage through their binders and be like, oh, you know, I got that in my box and, you know, didn't think anything of it. Copies are going to come out of the woodwork now that the card is valuable. The price is going to go down, you know, approach like 10, 12 bucks. If you buy in at 10, you're going to end up selling for 10. So definitely know when you've missed the window.
If you think you're on time, you're already too late.
Right. All right. So, yeah, I mean, that's 101 for this week. It sounds like Boston was both a fun event for those playing and for those not playing in Jason's case. So let's move into an email we have this week. So our email this week comes from Chris Vinton. He says, Brainstorm Brewery. First off, let me say that as someone getting back into Magic from being off since Ravnica, I really enjoy your podcast offers. Listening to what you guys speculate has the added bonus to give me a helpful push towards what will be good in a format coming up. I also like your new segment, Finance 101. When someone becomes confident and able in a skill, they often forget what it took to get there or how they even got there. As much as the subject might sound trivial to you, it is not so to us just starting to dabble. I really appreciate you guys doing the segment, and I hope to glean as many financial tips from the show as possible. You guys often talk about speculating rares and mythics. With that said, I do have a question for everyone on the show. What about the commons and uncommons? Are they worthy speculations? I imagine once you're a boss at speculating, putting a few $100s into multiple copies of a rare is more comfortable than if you are a neophyte like myself. I've been looking at what cards are played in Legacy and Modern. It seems commons and uncommons matter the most there, and one that comes to mind is Reclamation Sage. It has replaced Harmonic Sliver 100% in a few decks for Modern. Currently, Sage sits at about 50 cents each on MTG Goldfish, but is available in large quantity on eBay for 35 cents. Foil Sages are $6. Would you recommend buying large amounts of the non-foil or a small amount of the foil? Which would be easier to unload once you feel close to the ceiling? If I should buy foils that I think will become modern staples, why not just buy into standard rares that are $6 each for a short-term game? Is it fair to say that Sage will follow the same trend? Am I just naive? Thanks for taking the time to read this email. Keep up the great work. So before we jump into that question, it's great to hear that you like the Finance 101. I mean, this is something that the listeners told us when we kind of rolled around to episode 100 and took a while to put it out, is that they, really wanted to hear some of the intro stuff, and that's what we've tried to do. So I'm glad to hear that it's working. So moving on to his question, say you find something like Reclamation Sage that is going to go into Modern and Legacy. Do you guys think it is better to get in on those extremely cheap non-foil copies or the foil ones at a larger buy-in? What do you guys think?
So I have a little bit of experience with this one. Wear and Tear was the last one I went in on. And it was a similar situation where normally I don't like buying into commons when they're first in standard. And the big reason for that being, obviously, like, there's a ton being opened. And until you see how many are out there and how much demand there really is for it. Because, yeah, it's going to replace Harmonic Sliver. But is there enough demand for Harmonic Sliver if it were printed in standard right now to make it an expensive card? Is the real question. And I think in those cases, you're probably safer going with the foils just because it's not something that's going to be a four of in a lot of decks. It's not something that, like in the next year, I expect it to shoot up in price or anything like that. So unless you plan on holding these for a couple of years, you're probably not going to see a big return out of it. As opposed to the foils, the moment that starts seeing play, like you already just saw what happened with Ensnaring Artifact there, or whatever that card's called, or Ensouled Artifact. The same thing can happen if you start seeing these decks running Reclamation Sage over Harmonic Sliver. I don't know why I can't say that card. And I think you have a much better chance for seeing that short-term, year-long to two-year-long gain on commons, and the foil versions.
Yeah, I'm with Ryan entirely because the if you look at something that like a Harmonic Sliver, for instance, the non-foil copies are just not that much. And if there's a if a common is $1.50, dealers can pay a quarter on it because they're just going to get people like us pulling them out of collections and selling it to them because there's no other way to get rid of them. But you know, when you look at the spread on that, paying a quarter for a $1.50 card is not that great to you selling it to them. However, those foils, the spread will look much better. So I think it is better, especially once you factor in shipping costs and all of that stuff that's flat, whether you're sending a foil or a non-foil, you're usually better to buy fewer copies of a foil than many copies of a non-foil when it comes to commons and uncommons.
This is also a game day promo, so you actually don't have to buy either. I think the game day promo is sort of a unique thing. I think people are just going to get those for participation, so they'll be easy to pick up and trade, which is always better than paying in for cash. And you know, the game day promo's got unique art versus the foil versus the non-foil. So that's something else to look at for Reclamation Sage. This is a card where modern kind of matters, but Harmonic Sliver and Reclamation Sage are both two cards that are going to be real EDH heavy. So if you're looking at a card that's not going to really impact Standard a ton outside of sideboards, or even Modern a ton outside of sideboards, but it's going to be something great for EDH, what is an EDH player going to buy from you? Are they going to buy four non-foil copies or one foil or one game day promo? So that's something to think about too. For EDH cards, you definitely want to target foil. For cards that are, you know, modern legacy, you definitely want to target the foils. And what's really the upside of buying the non-foils? Like, you have to find a lot of people to buy those copies from you. $600 worth of the non-foils is going to be impossible to get rid of it, like, in your lifetime. But $600 worth of the foil, you know, that's, if people are buying playsets, you only got to hit up 25 people. So, that's a little bit easier. I mean, you're dealing with fewer fees, fewer transactions, fewer stamps, blah, blah, blah. I really think that something that's got a, you know, if the non-foil, like, doubles, then you did pretty well. But, you know, you can get, like, deck tupling on the foil. So the growth potential is bigger on the foil also. So for all those reasons, I got to agree with my co-hosts.
And here I disagree with all three of you. But just for the Europeans, because here with Magic Card Market instead of TCG Player, we don't have these transaction fees. And I've actually been selling a lot of commons and uncommons in play sets that I've seen play in Modern and Legacy that have been going for 75 cents to a euro. And the same thing could happen to cards such as Reclamation Sage. A little less on this one, though, because it's mostly a one-off. But the thing to do with these is you put them in a large box. You trade for them, obviously, as throw-ins. And you put them away and you forget you have them for about 3 to 5 years. And once you grab them again, they're worth up to a euro, sometimes even two or three. For example, Keen Sense might be just the scarcity, but it's already 2.5 euros. And the thing is, with commons and uncommons, is that it isn't that they're necessarily that rare, but that people just don't want to go look through their entire collections to buy them. So it's actually a decent opportunity here to make some money long-term for very little effort.
So are you telling me that we pay like 15% to eBay and 10% to TCG Player, and MTG Card Market charges not that much?
MTG Card Market, the only thing a seller pays is the 5% commission fee. No stamp, no envelope. That's all the cost of the buyer, not the seller.
Uh-oh.
So, yeah.
Wow. Mind blown right now.
I guess so.
Yeah. So,
and they use the metric system. Why do we live in fucking America? Why bother?
America, so I don't know. Jason, come on.
Well, one thing to keep in mind is opportunity cost, and I think that's going to be a finance 101 later on at some point, maybe a whole episode. But, you know, he was talking about standard cards. If he puts his money in standard cards, he might be able to flip those a little sooner than you'll get your money out of Reclamation Sage. And you might be able to put your money into it a little bit later after you made some flips. So that's something you want to consider and thing to think about of what you want to do with it. It's probably a safe long-term bet, but again, it's going to be more of a long-term, except for the foils. Foils will have more volatility.
Yeah. But, right. One thing to keep in mind with the standard cards is obviously that for the standard specs, you have a time window, and for the longer term ones, you don't. So just make sure you don't miss them, and standard should be fine.
Standard is going to be fine, because they just did an announcement, actually, at the San Diego Comic-Con. If you guys didn't miss it, or you weren't paying attention to social media, or you still haven't paid attention, or you don't know what's going on, then I guess we're going to tell you about Kanza Tykeer. We got a wedge set, which is probably the biggest news of it all. It's going to be a tri-color set similar to Shards of Alara, but it's going to be using the enemy colored. So you're going to be having all the opposite colors of whatever Shards of Alara. We could go down the entire line. Corbin, do you want to actually read the new names of the new guilds that are going
to
be coming
Marcel, out? Marcel, please be the one to read.
No, make Corbin do it. I really want to hear Corbin's.
No, I want to hear Marcel do
yeah.
it.
Oh, yeah, give me the list. Let me look at it. I'll look
First
at
of
it.
All, Marcel, the name of the set is Cons of Travis, as you said last week.
Did I? Oh my goodness!
I don't remember that, last but week. I believe it.
Yeah.
The narrative that we're going with now is that you said Cons of Travis.
I
have the list.
There's going to be a lot
up.
Of people. There's going to be a lot of people screaming. A lot of people screaming con at you while you play, and that's going to get annoying very quickly.
Absolutely.
Don't ever play L5R, though.
Okay, guys. Red, black, white is the Mardu Horde. They have the dragon aspect of speed. Their symbol is the wing of the dragon, and their con leader is Zergo Helm Smasher, which I thought was a cool name, and every time I read that, I think it's less and less cool. Jeskai, I'm glad Jeskai came along, because maybe people will say they're playing Jeskai instead of saying American.
I don't think they're gonna do that. Pretty sure they're gonna say American.
Like, whether you say Jeskai or whether you say you're playing American, like, you sound equally, like, mentally ill, so I guess it doesn't matter. The Jeskai Way, that's their horde is called the Way. They're red, white, and blue, cause these colors don't run! Cause they don't have the speed of the dragon, they have the cunning of the dragon. Their symbol is the dragon's eye, and their con leader is Narset. That's the picture they have along with the Jeskai Way. People are already photoshopping because it looks like the DVD cover to Kung Fu Panda with the guys they got all in their kung fu stances there.
I will admit that this next one I legitimately do not know how to pronounce it.
What's Sultai?
I'm imagining it's Temur.
Temur.
I'm going to say Temur because there's a bone in your leg called the femur. So
you are correct.
I had heard that it was Temur.
No, it's Temur. We got the blog talk. Mark Rosewater has them all fanatically out here. It's Temur.
Okay, Temur. They have the aspect of savagery. So this is Rug, by the way. The Temur are Rug. They have the aspect of savagery. Their symbol is the claw of the dragon. And their con leader is Surak Dragonclaw. Because, you know, he's real creative. Because they're the claw of the dragon. So, Surak, come up with a better name. Your shit's weak. Moving on, Bug is the Sultai Brood. They are ruthless. They have the ruthlessness of the dragon. Their symbol is the Fang of the Dragon, and their con is Sidisi. Not sure, like, why these people have one names like Madonna or Prince, and some of them have, you know, cool names like Zergo Helm Smasher, but.
This tribe is also the closest thing we will see to Merfolk in this block.
Oh, yeah, that's brutal.
Why do you say that?
Tarkir's landlocked, suck it.
Yeah, finally. Well, at least snake tails.
Finally, Junk. Junk is Abzan. And I'm actually, I thought I would really like Rug or Bug or something like that. The Temur or the Sultai, but I'm like in Abzan and their symbol is endurance, their aspect is endurance and their symbol is the scale of the dragon. So when I think endurance and scale of the dragon, I think all kind of crap, like indestructibility and, you know, getting stuff out of the graveyard and all the stuff that Junk represents. So, like, I'm actually – I think Abzan might be the way to go at the pre-release. I'm looking forward to it.
Does anybody think that people – I mean, here's the question. Does anybody think that people are going to say Sultai and Temur instead of Rug and Bug? And are we going to try to say Abzan?
I didn't think people would say Bant. I didn't think
what would they call it though? Grixis? Like, what was it before? I came in around those sets.
It wasn't
so like,
before. This is actually good because it's two syllable. This is perfect for any way to make this grokable, and people are going to embrace this. So people are going to not say give up Rug. Some people are not going to give up Bug because there's a lot of feelings attached to them. It's easy to say.
I mean, it's also, it is easier to say bug and rug.
Yeah, but
than
eventually
it is to
people,
say these other words.
But as over time, within a year, you're going to be, these are going to be rolling off the tip of your tongue. Like these are just, these are just, you know, foreign to you right now because America, America. Yeah, no, that's what it is.
Abzan is like,
so they said they were
not pleasant to say.
And they were called Babo. You would probably remember it overnight or, you know, Hillary.
Babo Horde.
Sue Ann, if they were named Sue Ann.
Well, I actually think that
Sue Ann's one of my ex-girlfriends.
Mardu actually is easy to say. But like Abzan just sounds like difficult.
Well, you know what? People were saying
Abzan.
Before Boros, before Ravnica, people were saying Jank for Red White. Like, you know, like there was, everyone had their little nicknames and some of them really caught on in the community, but like now that there's something sanctioned, you don't have to have that local lore that spreads. They have something sanctioned by Wizard and everybody finds out about it at the same time. So, you know, the people that don't, haven't been playing for a long time are going to start saying that. It's going to really catch on. Just like Bant, just like Grixis. Okay. I really think people, as dumb as some of these are, like, I think that's, it's going to catch on. I think people might still say bug and rug and junk, maybe, but I was surprised at how the Alara shards caught on.
Yeah, and over coverage, and coverage is definitely going to be a big part of this now that we got as much video.
I'm sure I will be doing my part on the coverage team to get the new words implemented. You know, it's just hard to imagine people wanting to say something else. Because like you said, wasn't red, white, black Daga before?
Yeah, it was.
Where does that even come from?
That comes from Apocalypse.
Planescape. Yeah, Apocalypse. Planescape.
Okay. But say, I like the idea because like you just said, it kind of just sprung up. However, before, and I didn't, like, I knew it was Daga, but I didn't know why. So now, like, you'll know why it's, you know, it's whatever. I think it's overall good.
People used to reference them as the Elder Dragons back when, like, that was the thing. So they've changed names over the years. It's nothing new.
Those Apocalypse ones were impossible to remember because they were all so similar. That was the big mistake they made. It was like Raka, Anna, Daga.
Yeah.
Zeta, like, they were so similar and you heard them all at the same time. You're like, which one is Zeta? I don't know. So, the fact that these are different enough and I don't know, I think these will catch on.
Yeah, I'm sure they put
not super financially relevant.
Well, it is because people are going to be buying cars now around these new mechanics, you know. It's sad to see that, Abzan is not going to be having Jace involved in it. It's got a long game mechanic, hopefully from the graveyard, it sounds like. And it doesn't look like the new Jace is going to fit into that role. So, I don't know. We'll see how the new Jace, only one of these tribes are going to have a graveyard mechanic or whatnot. And I think that's going to be the case since we already see the setup with the green black, graveyard deck. So it's going to be interesting to see how Jace plays out into this.
Well, I'm thinking Jeskai might have, I don't know, some sort of card draw. The fact that they're Eye of the Dragon and they're like the dragon's cunning. I think they will probably be able to make use of a card that has pseudo card draw. You know, it has card selection, so that's the thing. I imagine that, you know, Jeskai was already probably going to play, you know, Jace and Elspeth and, you know, whatever Wrath we get, the Wrath of Khans. So I got a feeling that Jace won't be necessary in a graveyard deck as much as, you know, it's possible that his card selection will matter. And let's not rule it out because even though green, black, white is the shard, there are two sets that aren't going to be shards, and there could be mono black cards in cons that use the graveyard, and you could end up building some sort of blue black thing. So let's not rule anything out.
I'm not ruling it out. I still like Jace, and I still like the opportunity. But you know, this is interesting. I like seeing the new set. So what do you think about the dual lands? Now, are we going to get? Obviously, we're going to get tricolor lands, which are going to be uncommons. This is going to be just like Shards of Alara. But do we get a rare set? Is this going to be fetch lands? Do fetch lands fit in this pretty well? Do we get the Onslaught fetch lands in the first set, and then eventually we'll get the Zendikar fetch lands in the third one, the next large block?
This is my prediction. Well, I do not think that we will get all 10. I think if we do get fetch lands, it will be allied fetch lands at some point in the block. And they'll definitely probably be, you know, the tri-lands from Alara flushed out for these new ones. But I think it would make sense if they wanted to put fetch lands in standard now, because they need a mass reprinting of the Onslaught ones, to put the Onslaught fetches in this, and then use 5 rare slots in Modern Masters 2, conceivably in summer 2015, for a reprint of the Zendikar ones because they do not need to put as many of them into circulation as they do Onslaught.
Why do they need to do the Onslaught ones?
Yeah. Because there are fewer Onslaught ones printed than Zendikar.
But they don't. No. They don't care. They like don't. They would make them legal in Modern.
Yeah.
And they don't need to do that.
Yeah, they need to print the Modern ones more than they need to print the Zen, yeah. Onslaught ones into
if
Modern.
If they print and the Onslaught ones, they are making Modern ones. Why would they?
Well, they're making a new breed, and the ones that are already going are outrageously out of control. They need to do a large printing type of situation similar to Ravnica to make the price of the fetch lands
that's
go back to
that's exactly what I'm saying. But if you're saying if you print Onslaught fetches and you have $10 Onslaught fetches, that brings a lot of prices down on the Zendikar ones because people can just use the Onslaught ones. What do you mean? And then you ease the supply of the Zendikar ones by putting them in Modern Masters too.
I mean, Corbin's right about that. That is absolutely what would happen.
It would, but it's not going to be nearly the same. Like, there's still people that need to have those certain color ones. It will definitely have an impact, but I don't see why they went. Like the reason I think they would put all 10 in the entire block. They got two large sets, so they could do five in one. And they're talking about like time travel. So who knows? You know, maybe the next large set has the other five, and do the time travel. It all makes sense.
The only thing is that. And then I've talked about this on the cast before. You put the five enemy colored pain lands into M15 with nothing to balance out that cycle. So if you want to keep the number equal, you put an allied colored cycle into cons.
But see, cons is already a wedge block, so you want to have maybe more of the enemy colors going.
All right, so why are we only looking at fetch lands? Like, I don't know, I've called it, I think the Grove of the Burn Willow cycle is gonna be this. I think it balances perfectly with the Pain Lands. It seems great.
There is no Grove of the Burn Willow cycle.
There can be. Eventually that will be a cycle, more than likely. It's a good set of lands, it's very balanced, it's fine.
Yeah, we're just guessing though, like, let's tell people something they can actually use.
Yeah.
Like, okay, every other podcast is guessing.
Well, sure. How much of a guess is that? You can actually use them. Stay the hell away from fetch lands in general. Like, that's all you need to know about this.
No, that is a good takeaway. Here's what I think. I think the fact that they have not given us any proof positive that any fetch lands, Onslaught or Zendikar, getting reprinted means that I spent all weekend seeing if the dealers were going to stop buying them and if the buy prices online were going to go down. Neither of those things happened. I think if anything had happened, if they'd showed a picture of a land that looked like it could be a fetch land. Like, I think the dealer's buy prices on all the would have gone down by $5. I think if you have them and you're not sure what to do, I think you want to sell now because if the reprint doesn't happen in this block, it'll happen soon. And I think if they do announce it, like, and you wish you'd gotten out, you're going to lose a lot of money. So if you have any inclination that you're not going to play any more Modern because, you know, the Modern GPs are over, we don't advocate selling lands because you have to rebuy them later, but they will be cheaper later. So if you balance the cost of not having them to play with in the interim and maybe they're printed next block, so like you could be, you know, without them for many months, if you're inclined to sell now, absolutely sell now before we have any information. You don't want to wait for confirmation. You want to sell before confirmation.
I'm with Jason.
See,
I
don't actually agree with you on this one. Everyone's like, what I'm saying is get out now of the old fetch lands. Like, I don't, those are going up at such a slow rate.
And especially with
Modern made such a push. The Modern ones though, I think you missed the boat. Like, even if they get reprinted, the old ones are going to hold a little bit more value, just like the Ravnica Shocks did. And if they don't double print them like they did with the Shock lands, they're not going to go down that far. Like, they're going to take a hit, but them being in Standard is going to balance a lot of that out. Like, they've already pretty well bottomed. This season hasn't done much for them. And I think that's mostly out of people just expecting them to be reprinted. So once they are reprinted, I think the price has already kind of adjusted itself.
Brian, hold up. Brian, you think that if they reprint Misty Rainforest in a Standard set, the Zendikar one is going to stay $70?
The what's that? How much is it?
It is $67 TCG mid. Do you think that?
No. You're not understanding though. So you're talking about the retail price of the card. You are not getting that price. If you sell out of that Misty Rainforest and then you have to buy back into that Misty Rainforest, the amount extra that you spend probably isn't going to be that much of a difference. The Misty is kind of the exception. Like, those $60 ones are a little different than the ones that are buy listing right now for like $20, which is the average for most of the other ones. But I really don't, I don't know. I just don't
there's
think
on, there's only five, shot. And two of them are 60 to 70.
And three of them are like in the 20 range, right? On Bylus? Those are the ones that I would definitely, I just wouldn't worry about it. Like they're 20, they might drop to 10, but by the time you sell out of them, like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people are going to sell out of them because they're so worried about it and end up having to buy right back into them at the same price or potentially even more.
You think they'll go up?
I don't think they'll go up, but I don't think the difference between what the buy list is now and what the retail will be that you'll have to rebuy them at is going to be enough to make you want to sell them and not play modern at all. Like you're putting
yourself
in a format by not owning them.
So you're saying
I think the amount of play value that you're going to get, unless you plan on playing zero modern for the next year, just hold on to them.
So you're saying that, say, Verdant Catacombs, say it's at $20, $25 on a buy list. You're saying that if it's reprinted in mod, if you sell yours for $25 and then you do not play modern for a year because that's how long you're waiting on the reprint, that the new copies of that card
will be 25 or more retail.
Will be 20 or 25 more retail and you will have missed modern.
I think your copy of that, if it will still be close to that amount, yes. And I don't, you don't know that they're being reprinted the next year. What I'm saying is the amount of risk that you're taking and the amount of loss that you can potentially take for this being reprinted is really minimal with the prices already dropping. Like, the blue ones are a little different. Like, those I might move out of. 60 is kind of a high bar. But at 20, like, what do you think they're going to be if they're in standard? They're probably still going to get 15. They're still going to be 15 a piece retail even for the new copies. That's what we saw with the Shocks when they were first announced. And you're going to have time at that point. Like, there's not, I guess, enough of a loss involved there for me to not want to hold on to them for a year for the cost of, like, $10 a piece, essentially. And that's, again, assuming that you're getting out of them at good buy list numbers now and you get good retail numbers on them when they get reprinted.
That's interesting because, like, Verdant Catacombs is 27 buy lists right now. I don't know. I think I just have to disagree because if they were to reprint Verdant Catacombs in a standard set, you are not going to feel bad about having sold your copies for $27
Sure, you might not feel bad, but the point is you're assuming that it's getting reprinted either in this first set or in this block in general.
I'm assuming
you
it gets reprinted.
You feel like a real asshole at the end of the year if you still want to play when it hasn't been reprinted.
I never said it would definitively be in the set. All it's going to happen in the next 2 years. I will stand behind that.
Sure.
So you don't want to play modern. Yeah, he's saying, do you want to
I understand his point.
Yeah, it's opportunity cost. Yes, you can make the maximum amount of money selling now, probably.
So I think it goes back to what Jason said, that is, if you have any inkling that maybe you don't need it, maybe you have 8 Burning Catacombs, right? Maybe sell those extra 4. You know, like, I think there's value in understanding where the prices are going to go, even if you don't want to sell. Because I do think there's a value to playing a format. Maybe you keep your 4 to play the format and you sell the rest to maximize value.
So
that sort of thing makes sense.
Here's the one other big question I pose for you. Everyone believes that in some form fetches are going to be in cons. What happens if something like this Grove of the Burn Willow Cycles or something else is spoiled for cons? Do you think fetches go up at that point because people are less concerned about it within the year?
Yes.
No.
Without a doubt, they will.
I think they will.
From where they are now, they're artificially inflated still.
Yeah, I don't think they go anywhere.
They're not artificially inflated. They see enough play to definitely hold those prices. I never have a problem getting
rid of them. You would have said the same thing in Richmond, though, Ryan. You would have said the same thing 3 months ago when they were $20 higher.
No, I did say they were inflated at that point. Like, that was too much. They bubbled for that event, and there wasn't enough. Like, I couldn't get rid of the ones I had back home. People were just like, nah, I'm going to pass on that. That's what I can tell, is when the private guys are coming to me and saying, yeah, I want to buy this card now because the price is low enough, then I know that typically means that if you can't keep it in stock for a certain price, that the price is low enough that people are okay and comfortable buying in, and it's not just hype.
Okay, well, I think we're probably about as divided on this as everyone out in the world is.
I mean, that's good. Usually,
yeah,
we all
I'm sure.
I am just going to trust Aaron's word and not get out of my fetch lands right now, because I don't think they're going to be reprinted in the upcoming set, probably the one after that. So you have enough time to either just trade up for foils, because they're not going down anytime soon, or trade them out if you have extra copies, because that is the best way to get value rather than buy listing them.
So speaking of value, let's talk about valuing these picks of the week. We haven't done this in a while, so let's give some honor to the segment.
Who picks of the week are back.
I want to go first.
No. We're going to let our guests go first.
Oh, okay. I have a bit of a controversial one coming back to the listener email. I'm going to pick an uncommon. It is Illusory Angel from M15, previously in Plane Chase 2012. It's now Modern Legal instead of only Legacy Legal, and it's actually quite a powerful card. In Modern, having a 4-4 flyer isn't bad. It's kind of like a mini Tarmogoyf with evasion. And you can actually cast it on turn 3 with 3 mana, because cards such as Gitaxian Probe and even Gutshot, which is starting to see a little bit of play, are available. Having a turn 3, draw a card, look at your opponent's hand, and put a threat on the board isn't bad. And at only currently 5 cents here over on Magic Card Market, I just say try to pick them up as throw-ins in trade and put them in a box, and maybe later in a Delver-style deck, they'll be there, worth up to $1 or more.
I do like
that's
that
not
one.
A bad call at all.
I thought about the modern implications of that card.
I thought it was only another blue spell, so I thought it only worked with Git Probe. But you're right, it totally works with Gutshot. I think, like we were talking about, this ties into earlier then, if you really like this, pretty soon here in maybe another month or two with more than 15 come out, foils of this will be absolutely dirt cheap, and they will move the hardest if it were to break out in modern.
Yeah, especially since it wasn't printed as a foil before.
Right. This is the only foil of this card.
Yeah, it wasn't foil in Plane Chase. I mean, Ryan was brewing with this back in the day in some sort of, like, Sea Stompy type variant.
That deck
you know,
was sweet. Sea Drake,
Serendib Afreet.
I ran Immensal Misstep, Daze, Force of Will. Like, you just sat behind Dark Confidant and, like, these guys and, like, card advantage your opponent out. Tempo.
Actually, over here in Europe, Illusory Angel sees play in the Peasant format, which is Pauper plus 5 uncommons, and with a format where you can pick Force of Will, Mental Misstep, or any other really insane blue uncommon, they pick Illusory Angel over anything else that actually already speaks to the power level of the card. So I have the absolute most trust that this is going to be a player at some time. And remember, the foils are here just under €2. They're really just really cheap to pick up.
And for toughness is kind of the magic number in modern, given that there's a whole bunch of different 3 damage spells that run around. Basically, of the commonly played stuff, it's only Path that deals with this.
And
it
also
blocks a Restoration Angel and wins. It's pretty
but not
relevant.
An Ensouled Artifact.
No, not that.
Okay, that's a good pick, Sander. And, for readers of our website, they'll remember that Sander was a little bit ahead of the spike on, what was that land?
Gavany Township?
Gavany Township.
Hopefully Steam Augury in the future?
I don't know about that, Sander. I think you're pushing Steam Augury.
Way better than James, at least.
I liked that card a lot when it first came out, and I still feel like it's a very skill-intensive card. It just doesn't have the shell yet.
Yeah.
You could get there.
Okay.
You definitely get there.
Right. You shouldn't have brought up Steam Augury. I wasn't going to embarrass you like that, but you don't seem
we'll
embarrassed.
See.
Let's.
Have 12 months.
Okay, I got a pick of the week. This is something I was talking about all weekend. I haven't pulled the trigger on as many copies as I was going to yet, because anytime I want to use something for pick of the week, it looks really, lame if I buy out the internet first. But I'm poised to make a move on these. Without further ado, I like Soldier of the Pantheon. This is a card that, I had a little bit of a faith in first, and it's gotten play, but not as much as it probably needed to. I think now, with Wedges announced and, the one card we've seen, Zergo Helm Smasher or whatever, I think if any one of these big legendary 3-color dudes is really a strong card, being able to block that or swing through it is relevant. I think there's going to be a lot of gold-colored removal that this, fogs. I think they're going to play gold-colored cards to develop their board, and you're going to gain that life. I think Soldier of the Pantheon is looking better in a wedge set than it was in sets where everyone was playing, monocolor affinity. Granted, monocolor affinity still ran stuff like Night Vale Spectre and Boros Reckoner, but I think Soldier of the Pantheon is very good in a wedge set format, and I think it's about as low as it can go.
Okay. Who wants to go next?
Well,
I agree.
Second, since mine just got jacked.
It went on Moto, it was like 30 cents when they announced the set, and now it's up to 68 cents, and I still think it's a good buy-in. It'll probably be like a $2-3 card at the worst. I think you should get in now. I think you still got opportunity to buy in for under a dollar.
Well, in the first couple of weeks of Standard, the reason that was going to be my pick is just because the first couple of weeks of Standard that we're seeing of this new format even is showing like green-white aggro kind of coming back a little bit, and it's running Soldier. And that's one of the cards that's kind of going to like make it through rotation, and that's probably still going to be an archetype of some sort. There's like typically a green-white little kid. That's a perfect place to start.
People always want a way to start their curve.
Yeah, well, that I think before what was holding that deck back is you didn't really have two phenomenal one drops, because like Experiment One is good in that deck, but it just a lot of times felt really underwhelming late game, and like the Sunblade Elf guy really boosted that deck.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the mana in that deck was never perfect either, because it took a long time to get the Green White Temple, and even that doesn't cast your stuff on turn one. Blah blah blah.
Yeah, I mean, Mana Confluence definitely helped that out too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. I do have a pick of the week. Heroes Downfall. I'm still on this card. I think this card is absolutely criminally underpriced right now. I understand it was reprinted. I don't care. This card is in everything right now, and it's not going to stop after rotation. I don't think this card is, you know, a Snapcaster Mage, but I don't understand why this card is under $10 as much. There's so many different archetypes that want this. And it's only becoming more and more with every different kind of brew I'm seeing. Between mono black, you have the black white. There's just too many decks that want this card as a 4 of across the board for this card to be this cheap.
Really? Even out of a okay. I mean,
it's a good card.
It was a 1 of in an event deck that how many
and it was opened a lot. I mean,
sure.
So were but the ones cheap. with Thragtusk, and it took 3 goddamn dual deck reprints.
You're comparing a core set to a fall expansion set. Come on.
I understand, but
I'm talking to Jason. Yeah.
I'm comparing a dual deck to a dual deck.
Oh, it was $5 of paper. Ooh.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the dual deck or the event deck. It's the copies of it that were open.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like this, yeah. I expect this card to at least double before it's out of standard, and I could see it hitting 15. Honestly, it depends on how much of a mainstay in the format it is. But this card will absolutely be over 10.
I think the reason why it's $5 is because mono black, and that's the biggest
reason.
It's
not just mono black though. There is so many different decks that are running this right now.
But
like,
it's not
looking at some of the standings and. Just from that SCG event alone, there was 4 different archetypes in the top 16 running this card.
And like, you know what? We're losing all the Ravnica block removal, so everyone's running Abrupt Decay and Dreadbore and Ultimate Price.
It's the third most expensive card in this, or it's the most expensive rare in this set, behind Sylvan Caryatid and Thoughtseize. I think 8 to 10 is reasonable.
Caryatid is holding the value it does with a promo printing, the event deck should not hurt this.
I mean, to be fair, that's 650. So, like, I mean, Caryatid's running a whole bunch of decks, too.
I could see Caryatid going up as well. Like, I think these cards that have really just been pushed down by the current standard, we typically see that. Look what happens every fall. You get the cards from last year that now aren't being opened. Nobody's got a hold of them. And yeah, I don't care that this was opened in a deck a while ago. Nobody's opening those decks now.
Well,
and
what's
the amount of these that are out there are out there.
The factor that you're
probably
missing there.
A whole lot of new ones coming to the
factor that you're missing there is the 20% annual player growth, which doesn't seem to be the case this year. That has done quite a bit to push up those prices over the past few years, and people have not attributed those price rises to that fact. And it's very relevant. So, I don't know. I'm with you though. Like, it's very good and it's played a lot. I wouldn't be surprised to see it at 8 or pop up to 10 even, but I agree. I don't think it's 15, but I do agree that it's a fine pickup at $5.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I want to go pay $5 cash on these, because even if it does double, like, you're still looking at about buy list at that point. But right. I think that you take any of these you see in trade at this point. And people are letting them go so easily just because nobody's thinking about, like, you know, it's such a staple to the format, though. You have to have 4 of these if you're playing standard.
All right.
Let's move on before you backpedal even more.
Go ahead, Marcel.
So my pick of the week is going to be pick up your Vintage Masters. If you haven't bought into them yet, if you haven't got your dual lands, get your dual lands on Modo right now, because they're probably going to be about as cheap as they're possibly going to get. If I understand right, and I've been trying to find this information for about the past 20 minutes, and it's impossible to find it on the Wizards website, but from what I understand, that they're going to be taking down some of the Vintage Masters events starting today, which is the 29th that we're recording. This will be the last day that you'll see the sealed dailies. And I believe there's going to be some form of the draft still going, but I believe they're going to cut that eventually. So you're going to see the supplies start to dwindle. And so you probably want to get in now before people start buying in and start speculating. You'll see the price of power starting to go up. You'll just see the price of staples all around Vintage Masters start to go up from this point on. So you might have a window. How long that window is to be determined. But if you're trying to get in or you've been waiting to get in, like, you should probably get in about now, because now's the time. And this is going to be a long-term call. Definitely everything in Vintage Masters will probably damn near be double. Some things won't, some things will, but some things will be higher than that. But yeah, Vintage Masters will go up. The demand's there. So getting your cars now is it's an opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
That's not a pick, man.
It was a good pick.
Didn't we say we were going to stop doing categorical picks? Like,
no. No, this is fine.
You have to tell people to buy. Like, I'll say the dual lands. Like, all the dual lands are just damn cheap. Like, you have to buy those. Like,
yeah, I mean, just because it seems obvious to you doesn't mean it's obvious.
No, it's not that it seems obvious. It's just it's so hard to track later.
Well, that's okay sometimes.
Yeah, that's really good advice, though, Marcel. So, like, that's legit, man. Like, that needed to be said.
All right, I'll round us off here. And we talked a little bit about this in our site review, but I still like it. Liliana Vess at $6. You know, we talked in the set review how it was pre-selling for $5 and none of the others were under $10. And as it stands now, Liliana is $6 and none of the others are under $10. So, this is $6 without even being considered in standard playable. Is it standard playable? I don't know. Then again, mono black is obviously very powerful. Liliana has been standard playable before. Either way, I think it's a good long-term pick at $6. So, you know, nothing groundbreaking there, but I do think it's a good pickup because before you know it, we will be into the fall and people will be talking about cons and there's just not going to be any M15 on the market.
This was $6 like before it got printed. It's really weird how like the Lorwyn's Planeswalkers seem to shrug off reprints and they always seem to maintain around, you know, $6 to $10. It's really weird. So, I don't know if being an M16 would even hurt it.
What about being a Commander 16? M16? Or is it Commander
M16?
Well,
Liliana Vess is not actually going to be eligible to be a Commander, but what we do have is a new Teferi with the clause at the bottom of the card that says this card can be your Commander.
Oh, this is why I'm not going to play EDH ever.
No, forget this card, it's not even good though, like, right? Like, it's cool, good. But it's
what
not
do you
even
mean?
Good.
You can act. You come in on doubling season. You can activate its
ultimate.
No, you don't.
The green one, sure. Not the blue one.
Yeah, the blue one is what is. It comes in with five, and then doubling season gives it 10.
If
and
this
then
is
you,
your general, you're not playing doubling season. That's what.
Like
he's
I said, the green one. The green one seems fine. The rest of these don't seem very good because the only people who play mono blue commanders are usually playing busted combo decks like Azami or like a dedicated control deck. And maybe this goes in that deck, but like it's a pretty small segment. And Planeswalkers draw a lot of hate when they hit the table in Commander. So like I said, I like the green one where you can stack it with doubling season effects. I don't like this one, although it is a very cool card design.
But what if you just had Teferi not as a commander, but just in your deck with doubling season? All of a sudden,
sure,
all
that
your,
sounds great.
All your super friends are insane.
And that's not groundbreaking. What's groundbreaking?
I have to disagree with you. Being a combo blue player, like that was the original deck I put together for commander. This guy is insane. Like the turnabout every turn for free when you're all your deck does is take a bunch of free turns anyway is kind of insane. Like the untapping for permanence seems really good.
So how do you feel about this, Jason, being the EDH player, having commanders now in the command zone? What do you think?
So Sheldon Menry has already, like, done some damage control on Twitter and Facebook and be like, Dear EDH, the sky is not falling. Do not worry. What they are not doing is retroactively making all planeswalkers eligible to be generals. So that was the main concern. I was like, oh, great. So Mind Sculptor can be a general? No, don't worry. And if the card doesn't have that clause on it, it's not eligible to be a commander. So this is the gimmick they're doing for Commander 2015, 2014. What? Next year's commander shit.
2014, November.
Cause, yeah. So next year's Commander stuff, this is going to be one of the gimmicks. Because, you know, we were thinking, wow, if they're not going to do more plane chase, they're not going to do Arch Enemy, they're just going to do, you're going to fart out a Commander set every year, they're going to have to, you know, come up with something new. I like this as a gimmick. You know, it means that those Commander sets are going to be monocolored, but I mean, it's going to be 15 new cards every year. They're going to have 15 new cards. So, you know, 15 new monocolored cards. I'm totally cool with that. I think I'm going to buy all of them, obviously. I'm going to identify which one I want to sock away. And I think the having the Planeswalkers as a general is a good gimmick, and I think people are going to really like it.
So here's the one question I haven't heard anybody ask. You said that they're not retroactively doing Planeswalkers. However, does that mean that Planeswalkers going forward, some of them may or may not be eligible for Command?
Sheldon put it like this. He said, some cards in Magic are allowed to break the rules, and they stay on the card if they're allowed to break the rules, a.k.a. Or, example being Relentless Rats. They have this clause.
The question is more that, like, is this something that we think we're going to see as a trend going forward? Like,
no.
I understand their whole rules part of it. I'm quite well aware of that.
But I think what he's saying is that this is not something that's going to happen regularly. This is something that will break the rules, like, Relentless Rats coming out is obviously still a very unique thing. It's been done, what, twice? Because there was Shadowborn Apostle? Like, I think he's comparing it to that to illustrate that this will not be the norm going forward.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I think because they would have to have that clause, and that clause would be jarring in a regular set.
Yeah, well, I didn't know if just like every once in a while maybe we get like a super cool one, and that's just like one of the selling points of that Planeswalker is that you can play it as a commander.
Well, they have it as an option. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm with Jason. I think this is just this year's gimmick, and it's fine.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm kind of hoping so. I mean, I don't play much commander, but I imagine that adding in, you know, half of every Planeswalker that comes out from here on forward as commanders would be kind of old after a while.
Right.
You know what is getting old is these seeded packs and these playable promos. But it seems like, you know, the Wizards has been listening, and they're actually going to change their entire policy around these playable promos.
We get credit for ranting about this last week, right?
Do we? I guess so. Yeah, we.
Is that how we listened to us?
They made last-minute decisions based upon podcast. And, you know, they made this announcement because of us. So, yes, you guys can send your tributes to brainstormbrew@gmail.com. Thank you for fixing this entire thing. No, but so they either created, I believe TSG said it right, either this is an amazing thing or this is probably the most horrible thing that ever happened to pre-release promos. What they're now going to be doing is 40 different pre-release promos. Now, supposedly it's going to be 8 from each color, the rares, and there's no announcement that it's going to be alternate art. Everything's going to be foil. What are the implications for this? I mean, if everything is different art and everyone wants to collect all these cards, like, is this now all of a sudden creating these hot demanded cards that are going to be chased that are just a whole new subset?
Certainly could.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
40 different rares randomly distributed in packs that you could open at the pre-release. I think they had it before. It was called booster packs. My God, like,
yeah.
Don't do the seated pack if, like, it's like you could get every rare in the set as your promo. Well, then don't do the fucking seated pack then.
Well, specify that it's rare?
Before we give them a bunch of shit, though, let's see how the set is set up. This could be something where maybe they're doing it less of like, all right, we're going to set every seated pack as the same, and maybe they're going to start treating it different based on how the set acts. And so maybe this is something where, like, the 40-card thing doesn't really make sense to us now, but once we see the spoiler, like, it'll make a lot more sense.
Yeah,
like, maybe there's certain rares they don't want you to be able to open in those packs or whatnot.
Yeah, and, I mean, you still, when you get to see the pack, you'll get one of the awesome rares in that color. So, I mean, it's still not like a random booster pack. So, I mean, there's that to it. We'll see. I think at least they're listening. And they're not continuing to follow the bad trend, so that's...
I think the reason they're keeping it around, and I had talked to somebody about this last weekend, this is something I had kind of forgotten about, because I haven't been, you know, near this level of player in a while, but a lot of people who show up to pre-releases show up, and they play a monocolor deck at home, and that's the only color they play. And that's it. And so when they get to go there and you're giving them a choice of their color, you're already helping them out. Like, it's not the proper way to teach somebody how to build a sealed deck, but those people aren't trying to go PTQ. They don't care. They want to have a good time, and you're ensuring that they at least have something in their color that is playable by giving them that seeded pack.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, I think we went into this deep last week. Is that was absolutely fine, but there were a lot of people who had preferences for colors, but felt pressured to choose the most powerful one based on the promo. Now, what I don't think this is it. 40 possible? Has it been confirmed that it is 40 rares or just 40 possible promo cards? Like, because it seems to me that you know, there's 40 promo cards in this this wedge. You're going to get one rare and you know, the other is commons and uncommons. So, like, basically a seeded pack with different stuff. And do we know the exact details of that?
Yeah, it says here it's going to be 40 promos, 5 per coin. Yeah, it doesn't say exactly rare. So I severely, severely doubt they're going to give you a promo that's not a rare. Like that is just disappointing.
Well, like I said, I think you will get a rare, but I think the rest will not be rares. Like, I don't think that they're making 40 rares in the set.
There's promo. There's 40 possible. You get a possible promo in your color, so you get 8 for there. You only get one promo.
No, I understand, but that would mean they've had to commission art for 40 of them, and so
that's,
on and so forth.
That's
so,
the big question. That's where right. They haven't added. Is it going to be alternate art? Are you just going to get a stamp on there that says the you know? The pre-release date, is that it's going to be the day as everything's differentiated. So, I mean, yep. Until we get more information, we don't know, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it'll be interesting to find out.
And saying, if say the worst case scenario, they get different alternate art on everything you got foils, what do you think that's going to do to the price to these?
I mean, it would certainly impact them a little, but
the good ones will be worth money and the bad ones will not be worth money, just like regular foils.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot we don't know. I guess that's the theme of the episode.
It's never mattered. Like, Wormcoil Engine is $15, and that was a pre-release promo. Like, you know, Emrakul. Like, it's never stopped the cards before. The good ones are worth money, and the bad ones are not worth money.
I mean, Curiatid's a better.
Yes.
Like,
well, yeah, it's a buy a box. Like that. So it's not less, but yeah.
That was buy a box.
I mean, it's still the same kind of.
Illustrates. Like, not even
the
close.
The extra promo doesn't kill the price. Yeah. The mythics are just a little bit different. Like, that's the Wormcoil and the Emrakul, like, obviously.
So, Sander, do you got something to say on this? Because we've been kind of just overriding.
Yeah, not much to add here. I just think it's good that people no longer have to play around a certain promo all the time. And, not much to add. I agree with most of you.
I think you're definitely right, because, like, you know, last week we were talking about how annoying it is to play the same promo. So, however it ends up being implemented, it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Yep.
So we got some changes. We got Sander on, and, you know, he's made it to the Pro Tour because he won a PTQ. But PTQs are going to go away, at least the way that we've known about them. There's now going to be PTQ Qs, qualifiers to get to the Pro Tour. And it's going to be
Man, that's wrong. Marcel, it's pre-TQs.
No, it's PTQQ because more crying happens.
Oh man, this is just confusing. See, I haven't even started to play in this part of it, so please just tell me more. Why don't you guys make it clear?
Take it away, Corbin.
All right, so here's what can happen. Were those fireworks?
Yeah, those are fireworks.
Like either fireworks or somebody's sharding.
Okay.
This is what I think of that mic you bought me, Marcel.
All right. So here's the way it's going to go now. In standing with Wizards' long-term goal of moving more events to the LGS rather than a tournament organizer at a large event, you know, they did it with pre-releases several years back. Now they're working with PTQs. One of the problems with the current Pro Tour is that there were simply so many events and so many people qualifying for it. It had grown a little larger than I think that they, you know, than what they thought was optimal. So now, you get the event to a LGS, they have a PTQQ or a pre-TQ or whatever you want to call it, where the winner, will qualify for a regional PTQ. So it basically functions like a Grand Prix trial in that the store can have one per season, and this allows you to get those F&M players coming in, and then the winner of that will go to the regional PTQ where the top four or possibly the top eight will advance to the actual Pro Tour. So this will probably cut down some number of entrants, but on the other hand, it takes it from where instead of having to spike a PTQ and win a top 8 against other good people, you simply have to top 4 or top 8 a tournament full of good people. And, you know, it's not like Grand Prix trials have ever been the most competitive thing. You go to some stores and there's 15 people there. So I think the people who want to qualify for the regional PTQ will do so, and then it truly tests your skill once you're there. The thing is, it gives more business to the LGS, and it makes it easier for people to take that leap from FNM to the PTQ because it's still happening there in their store. So that's, you know, kind of explaining the background of it. Sander, what's your take on it as someone who has been in the PTQ system?
Well, right now you really need to spike. You really had, for example, last Sunday I had to go accent one, but I made it in with a drop. But usually that doesn't happen. I ended up eighth in the top eight. But having more events is good, mostly because you broaden your player base for the PTQs, which you already mentioned, which actually has quite some funny financial implications, which we haven't actually covered yet. For example, we no longer have seasons, and these qualifiers can go on all year, and the format that's being played is dependent on the TO. So the TO decides whether it's sealed, standard, or modern, which means that the prices, for example, of modern or standard, no longer have the spikes of the season, but flatten out at a regular rate, which means that jumps will happen less frequently because of seasons.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in this modern season, it kind of shown that modern wasn't liable for the same price spikes and ebbs that old extended was, where people only got their cards for the season. So I think that it will, like you said, balance out those spikes rather than them happening year to year. And what's interesting is how it'll impact standard season, or if stores just, you know, because standard's the most played format. If stores are just going to run standard instead of sealed events, that may be putting less sealed product on the market when you don't have an entire season of sealed PTQs.
Although sealed PTQs or PTQQs means more money for the store, so they might still, or might actually want to do more sealed
PTQQs. Yeah, I mean, so it's definitely going to be different. People are pretty divided on it. I personally think that while a lot of people are focusing on it's going to be less slots for the Pro Tour, they are ignoring the fact that Grand Prix are giving more now. And as well as, it's just overall good for Magic to move more events into the LGS level. So I think overall it's a net positive for the game, even though obviously whenever there's change, the same people who complain about having to win an event rather than just top eight it, are now complaining about it being changed. Everyone who's silver in the Pro Players Club, gets an invite to the, regional PTQ. So that's another way for those people to kind of benefit to them to stay on the train. So I don't know. Overall, I think all the changes, when taken together, which includes more Grand Prix happening next year than did this year, are going to be for the betterment of the game.
And Aaron Forsythe said that, you know, people are worried about giving this into the hands of the stores, and that giving them control of what format is going to be in. And Aaron's like, you know, just let this happen, see how this will work out. If it turns out that it is going to go bad, they'll just take the reins control again. So, you know, let's see how this works out, and I'm pretty sure that this will be a positive change.
People are worried about a bad LGS, but they weren't worried about a bad, you know, TO. Like, this prevents bad TOs from getting anything bigger than, like, a local in-store tournament. You know, like, bad TOs were getting whole PTQs and, like, you know, screwing over the vendors and just making the whole thing just an awful day. Like, I think it's better to get this, bring that money into the store, you know, that serves a community rather than the TO that just basically serves itself. I think this means people don't have to travel as far to grind. Like, you'll have to go far for the PTQ, but for the PTQQ, like, you can play those locally. There's a lot of, this is absolutely net positive. There are a lot of good things that we haven't even seen yet that people are just starting to think about, but this is absolutely very, very good. And I'm somebody that really supports the LGS, and I think this is going to be good on the LGS level.
I mean, I think this mirrors the exact same thing, and we'll probably be saying almost the exact same thing in a couple of years that happened with pre-releases, which is, like, at first everyone kind of freaked out about it, but you get down the road and, like, yeah, I kind of miss, like, having that huge pre-release, but at the same time, it's just so much more convenient, and it means, like, you're not going to the PTQ, like, once you've made it to the actual PTQ part, like, it's just, like, going and playing in, you know, like, any other major tournament, but you don't feel like you have to devote an entire weekend to going and grinding these PTQs over and over again, because you either make it to that tournament or you don't, and it's one weekend you set aside. And that's a lot easier for most of the local guys that aren't, you know, hardcore grinders and can't take every weekend to play Magic. I think it's much easier to set aside that one weekend if you do qualify locally.
Yeah, I've seen
go ahead.
Yeah, like I've seen Chris Pakula. He was talking about this is really good for him because he's not a grinder like this, that he only has to try to, you know, get one qualifier per season, and after that you could rest off and, you know, just live your life normally. So I think this may be better and may open the doors for some people that are, say, in my position that are professionals and may want to try to grind and get on the circuit. So, you know.
So the one thing, you know, we obviously have the U.S.-centric point of view. Sander, how is this going over for you over there?
Well, usually we only have a few PTQs over here. For example, only two for this season, which means that we have a lot of Belgium and German players coming over. For example, I kicked out a German guy in the finals. But we usually don't travel a lot. We don't go to France. We don't go to Spain. We don't take those 10, 12-hour drives that I hear about sometimes about people doing that in the U.S. So having more tournaments for us and making it a little more exclusive is better, because everything is now regional rather than for us international in some cases. So all in all, it makes it easier for a Dutch person to win a Dutch PTQ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the one negative that we haven't touched on is that you have to have a level 2 judge run your event. There are no level 2 judges in Oklahoma. I don't personally know the reasons behind it, but it seems to me that L1s could conceivably run it. I don't know. I mean, I certainly understand, since it's for it's something that in a way leads to the Pro Tour, you want a good judge on there. But I mean, there's no L2s in Oklahoma. Like, how does my store that I help run events for even supposed to do this? We have to find somebody to bring in. So that's the one thing I can see that, you know, could cause some problems for people.
You'll have to step your game up. Is that what you're saying?
But like, it's not even a matter of that. Like, am I supposed to become an L2 from a not a judge right now so we can do this? Like, the L2s are going to be in very high demand, and there are none in Oklahoma. I mean, it's not a question of stepping your game, but it's just a question of literally this is the situation we're in. And I can't imagine that we are, you know, all that dissimilar from other places in the country or world.
Yeah, Jeremy Schofield went into this on the A-Team, I believe, their last episode or the one before. He has a similar problem with the way that they changed the judging and what it takes to become an L2. And, like, him actually, when he was with us in Montreal and he missed that test, turned out to be one of the worst things he could have possibly done in his path to become an L2. So, similar blight, you could probably listen to that, or other people want to listen to that, and they could hear some of the stuff, that what goes on and what you can do about it.
Yeah, so speaking of judges getting shafted, they will no longer receive foils and GPs. They've cut that entirely.
Well, I think it probably goes along with the fact that GPs are now the slimy Boston was like nearly 2,400 players. We've had several over 4,000, blah, blah, blah. That's a lot of promos, which I think is probably a part of it.
They're doing it a little bit more meritocratic, I think. But, yeah. You know, you got to get nominated. Let's be honest, people are going to nominate their friends. It's just a new program they're trying. I don't know why they deemed it necessary, but, you know, we're not inside the judges program. I haven't heard, you know, many of my judge friends that are super excited about this, but I don't know. I don't think it's going to matter financially to non-judges.
No, you know, but it certainly does for judges, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's a big deal to them to lose out on that.
But there's no way they calculated that this would completely de-incentivize anybody from judging and, like, you know, be catastrophic for the number of judges they have at events. They had to have calculated that this will be fine.
But we would hope
not
that
lower
they,
judging quality.
Yeah, we had hoped that they spoke with TOs, who I think basically it falls on to pick up the slack, you know, given that people sell the boxes and they sell the promos and all of that to kind of pay for the trip. You know, I think it falls to the TOs to kind of pick up that slack. And I think Wizards probably went to them and said, hey, we're providing, you know, this is all speculation, obviously, but if you're getting this large an event, you can step it up a little bit for these extra judges.
Just so hopefully knows anything right now though. Like, I'm friends with a lot of judges on Facebook and they just don't know. No one's saying anything because, who knows if the TOs are going to be like, all right, we're paying now, or, you know, we have our own incentive thing. Like, judges are, no one can do what the judges do except judges. So they are going to be in demand. There's got to be some way that they are going to be incentivized to judge the events. So if the TO has to pick up the slack, the TO has to pick up the slack. Like, there's just no way that it's not worth it to judge because of this. And, like, we won't have Magic anymore. There's just no way.
That's a lie. Magic's going to end. It's doom. The reserve list is going to get unbanned. And
they don't do paper as bad as they do Modo.
Ugly.
Hey, Modo actually did pretty well. It's about the Doomsday prices never came. So, I don't know. It's starting to look good. John Logs is talking about spending money on Modo.
It's also starting to look good to wrap up this podcast and call it a night.
Agreed.
Yes, well, let's get out of here.
Morning.
Yeah, morning for Sander.
It's 8 a.m. here.
It's 8 a.m. in Holland. Thank you, Sander Vanderzee, for waking up extra early and dealing with our dirtling, because you know it takes us 3 hours to record a one-hour cast. I appreciate you hanging out. Congratulations on winning the PTQ. Good luck in Honolulu. And, Sander, you got to write me an article, man. Get something turned in.
I've been a bit slacking, but thanks for having me, and I hope to be back. I will be back.
So where can they reach you on Twitter? What's your name and or any other?
They can find me at The Meddling Mage. So not Meddling Mage, it's The Meddling Mage. All one word. Or they can reach me at on my mail at sen2z. So that's san2z at hotmail.com.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Ah, okay. Fine. Bye. I've only received one listening email so far. So.
Oh, all right. Cool. Well, expect many more.
Okay. Ask me anything. Anything.
Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.